During this past week, guns made the news in a couple of ways. There was first the discussion about the Second Amendment and gun violence at the presidential debate. Then later this past week, that was followed by the gun attack by a South Carolina teen on a school. These two instances bring about a discussion which too often relies on inaccurate beliefs and ineffective ideas. My next guest is dedicated to bringing the facts about guns, gun rights, gun violence, and gun crime to the center of attention. He does just that with his latest best-selling book, The War on Guns, Arming Yourself Against Gun Control Lies. He's also the founder of the Crime Prevention Research Center, Professor John R. Lott. Thanks for being here today, Professor.
Oh, thanks very much for having me on.
And for Crime Prevention Research Center, it's crimeresearch.org. Learn more about this and the other issues that they place in their focus. And as I mentioned, background checks, gun-free zones were the topics of this past week. Let's start with background checks, which is something that, as general and as vague as Hillary Clinton presented them, and it makes one suspicious that her intent is far more than just background checks to keep criminals from getting guns. Is there any hard evidence that background checks actually do prevent the significant amount of gun violence that we see?
No. I mean, everybody wants to try to keep criminals from getting guns, but the problem is that, exactly as you say, that there's really no evidence that background checks have been any more successful in stopping criminals from getting guns than bans on illegal drugs have been really successful in stopping people from getting illegal drugs to go and buy. But they do have some real consequences. The current system's a mess. Basically, they say about 2.4 million dangerous prohibited people have been prevented from buying guns because of background checks, but that's simply not correct. What it is about 2.4 million initial denials, and virtually all those are mistakes. It's one thing to stop somebody who's a felon from buying a gun. It's another thing to stop somebody simply because they have a name similar to a felon from buying a gun. I'll give you a simple example. People may remember the late Senator Ted Kennedy. There were five times where he was stopped from flying on a plane because he had a name similar to someone who was on the no-fly list. Now, I assume we wouldn't count that as five times we stopped a terrorist from flying, but that's essentially what they do when they talk about these background checks for guns working. And the problem is that virtually all, something over 99% of those 2.4 million denials are mistakes, where you had law-abiding citizens who should have been able to buy guns, but were stopped from doing so because of the background checks. And you have a couple problems. One is some of those people may have really needed guns quickly for self-defense, and they were stopped from getting them. Two, the people who are overwhelmingly stopped for these mistakes are blacks and Hispanics. They're the ones, you have law-abiding citizens in both groups who wanted to go and get guns, but simply were stopped because their names were similar to people who the government really did want to stop. And third is you have these fees and other things for people to go and process through this. And the ones that they primarily stop, again, are poor minorities in those groups.
I often think, too, with those fees, how much of the background check system is really a scheme for a lot of communities, a lot of states who are really dying as far as finances are concerned, to just be a revenue razor at the cost of the Second Amendment.
Right. Well, I mean, I think the main purpose of this is just to stop people from owning guns, particularly poor minorities. I'll give you a simple example. In Colorado in 2013, when they were passing these background checks on private transfers, I was called by some state legislators and asked to suggest an amendment to the bill that was going through the legislature at that time. And I suggested that they go and pass an amendment that would exempt people below the poverty level from having to pay the new state tax on transferring guns. With the exception of two pro-gun Democrats, every other Democrat in the state house there voted against exempting people below the poverty level from having to pay the tax. I mean, how many taxes can you think of that Democrats would fight tooth and nail against exempting people below the poverty level from having to pay?
You found the exception to the rule, I fear. We're talking with John R. Lott, The War on Guns, Arming Yourself Against Gun Control Lies, his latest book. He's the founder of the Crime Prevention Research Center, which is found online at crimeresearch.org. And you are listening to Issues and Ideas. You alluded to how statistics are gamed in a lot of cases. I mean, we think of stats as concrete, but there are quite a few anti-gun groups who seem to find a way to bend that concrete, don't they?
Right. Well, I mean, you literally have hundreds of millions of dollars being spent by people like Michael Bloomberg and George Soros putting out these numbers. And the media, unfortunately, uncritically covers this. You know, they just don't, they don't even ask people on the other side of the debate whether there might be mistakes when it's a Soros study that's done or a Bloomberg study. I mean, one could compare it to the NRA. If the NRA were to go and fund research, I'm sure the media wouldn't even cover it at all, let alone give it uncritical coverage. But somehow they don't view Bloomberg or Soros as being unbiased sources for information.
And in his book, Professor Lott writes about how the Bloomberg group, for example, will take FBI stats, which factually they are doing, but then they'll count a single-person suicide as a mass gun shooting.
Yeah, I mean, you look at their numbers for things like school shootings. You can have gangs shootings that are not even on school property as, some fight over drug turf as a school shooting, or you have somebody who commits suicide even off of property, or you have cases where somebody used a gun defensively when they were legally allowed to do so on school property as a school shooting. So, I mean, it's not, they've been called on those types of things by some fact checkers, but it doesn't seem to stop a lot of the media from using their claims uncritically.
And let's move over to school shootings. And before we do, I want to give recognition to the local firefighter in South Carolina, Jamie Brock, who managed to stop the 14-year-old shooter, Jesse Osborne, restrained him until law enforcement got there. And the cost was only 3 injuries. Fortunately, it could have obviously been a lot worse. But again, it's a school that was a gun-free zone. Yet it's sort of like a reverse of the old George Carlin joke. People who are afraid to have prisons built in the neighborhood, well, what is a prisoner going to do when he gets out of there? Hang around? No, he's going to get as far away as possible from that prison. Gun-free zone is an exact opposite of that. It seems to be the welcome mat for gun violence. How much do statistics support that idea?
Well, I think they strongly support the claim that you just made, and that is, you look since 1950, over 98% of the mass public shootings in the United States have taken place in areas where general citizens aren't allowed to go and protect themselves. And I suppose the easiest way to think about this is, let's say, God forbid, somebody was stalking or threatening you or your family. Would you put a sign in front of your home that said your home was a gun-free zone? Do you think that would stop the person from engaging in an attack? I think almost nobody would put a sign like that in front of their home, because rather than discouraging the attack, it would actually serve as a magnet. The person would feel that they'd be more likely to successfully commit the attack without being stopped. So, and the thing is, you just find statement after statement by these mass public killers where they explain why they picked a target. There's just a case this spring in Detroit where a father was concerned about his son's involvement with ISIS, and so he told the FBI about it, and the FBI put a tap on the son's phone, and they have him recording a very chilling conversation where he was talking to a compatriot about attacking one of the largest churches in the Detroit area. And the top reason why he gave was that he had checked and the church did not allow anybody to have permanent concealed handguns on church property, and that would make it easier for him to kill lots of people before anybody would be able to be there to stop him. He's very explicit in his language.
And just to add to what Professor Lott said, since 1950, some people will argue against that, saying, well, you do a wide frame like that, and you can do percentage and being in favor of gun-free zones. But if you want to narrow it down, since this was from a Stanford University study on mass shootings. Since 2002, there have been 54 mass shootings. 37 of those took place in gun-free zones, where only two armed civilians either slowed or stopped the shooter. Obviously, in the gun-free zone, ooh, there were two people breaking the law, technically, but fortunately, they were there to prevent any victims. But just to wrap up, 30 seconds between.
Well, I mean, I can go and give. If you go to our website at crimeresearch.org, or even I have a list in the book of War on Guns. I can give you dozens of cases in just the last few years where either police, sheriffs, or prosecutors have said that a person with a permanent concealed handgun has stopped what otherwise would have been a mass public shooting from occurring. I can give you cases like last year at a volunteer fire department in South Carolina. It was Kids Day. They were giving kids rides on fire trucks and ice cream. A man came up, started firing his gun. Fortunately, there were two volunteer fire department men there who had concealed handgun permits, and they were able to stop the attack. In Chicago last year, there was a gang member that went onto a busy sidewalk, started shooting at people. An Uber driver had just dropped off a fare. Fortunately, he had a permanent concealed handgun, got out, wounded the attacker there. The state's attorney said that he had come to the aid and protected many people that otherwise would have been hurt. You have a case in Conway, Georgia, at a liquor store where a man came in, started firing his gun, killed two people. Fortunately, there was a concealed carry permit holder who was walking by outside the store, came in, exchanged fire with the gunman, and the gunman ran away. The sheriff for the county said that there was no doubt in his mind that the permit holder had saved many lives. And that's just three. I can give others from Pennsylvania and other places last year. And we have cases this year. They don't get national news attention. These cases get local attention. But, there are lots of cases where you can point to where what would have otherwise been a mass shooting of four or more people killed was stopped before it became that.
And that's why Professor Lott's book, The War on Guns, Arm Yourself Against Gun Control, Lies, is important, because as you listen to the two presidential candidates and their ideas, their policies on guns, gun control, gun laws, and gun rights, you can compare their ideas and program ideas to the facts that Professor Lott presents in his book and arrive at a very intelligent decision when you walk into the voting booth. Come November, he is the founder of the Crime Prevention Research Center, online at crimeresearch.org. Learn more about this issue and others as well. And again, the book is The War on Guns, Arm Yourself Against Gun Control Lies. Professor Lott, always appreciate you being here. Thanks again.
I really appreciate your time.